Hello, my name is Floyd Maxwell, justthinker.com. This is the Floydcast number 4, or 0004, for those who like triple zeros. Bunch of good things to report this week, or to talk about this week, and share. Went to the Western Antique Aeroplane and Automobile Museum on the weekend. That's called WAM with three A's. And, you know, there's a famous museum in McMinnville in Oregon, and where the Spruce Goose is. That's where most people go. I've gone there. Huge hangars there. The Spruce Goose is so enormous. It's steroidal. It's like looking at Paul Bunyan as opposed to a normal person. That's how big the Spruce Goose is. It really is that big. Inside the Spruce Goose, it's like 12 or 14 or 16 feet high inside. The carrying space inside is 16 feet high and 30 feet wide and like half a football field long inside the main fuselage. The wings of the Spruce Goose are 10 feet thick. You know, most wings, you don't exactly walk in them. The Spruce Goose wings 10 feet thick. You could be the tallest person in the world and be able to stand up inside the wing. So, far and away, the McMinnville Museum, the Spruce Goose is the biggest draw. But there's an SR-71 Blackbird there. Now, that's not too shabby. The real deal. I don't know how many of those are in existence, but one of them is in McMinnville. And, again, super, supremely cool vehicle. And yet, at the same time, when you see it, and you're looking at it from a distance, of course, not that far away. Say 5-10 feet, closest you can get. You don't go inside. You know, it's sort of like everything you thought the SR-71 was, but nothing extra. And, you know, they have volunteers there and planes of all kinds. You got planes tucked under the wings of planes. But mostly, you know, airplanes there. And there is a space area as well. And they got a bunch of booster rocket, you know, engines. And they have an area where they sort of show a history of space. And you just kind of walk past these sort of muralish wall things. There's a tri-motor outside. There's like a famous prop engine plane from 60, 70 years ago. But we got an inside track on this WAM museum. Relatives bought us tickets for the family to go. It's a heck of a drive, but anyway, they work there, they volunteer there. And so they were our tour guides. And, you know, I'm normally anti-museum. I've almost never had a good museum experience. Or maybe what it is when it is a museum or when it feels like a museum, I don't enjoy it. And when it feels like something else, I enjoy it. Like, to me, these airplane places are not museums. I don't know why I have an arbitrary difference in my mind. I think what it is a museum in the real crusty old sense of the word is, you know, drawers and drawers of stuff, and it sort of smells dusty and moldy, and, you know, you see an old uniform on some guy, you know, some mannequin with the uniform, you know, from 80 years ago, and you're like, what's the point? Whereas when you see a SR-71 Blackbird, you're like, oh, yeah. It's just so cool, so outrageously cool, such innovative design 60 years ago, and it's innovative today. It hasn't been equal today. When it retired and flew its last flight, it set records on its last flight. That means that in its entire career, no one was better, no one was faster. It's so supremely elegant in its look, the Blackbird being black, the graphite body. The fact that when you fill an SR-71 up with fuel, it leaks fuel when it's taking off until it's heated up by the air friction of going 2,000 miles an hour. Until it heats up, it leaks fuel. Like, you imagine designing a vehicle that leaks fuel until it heats up? I mean, it's just so advanced, so great. The look of the engines, and of course, when it fires up the afterburners, you know, that those special flames that come out the back are pretty cool. Anyway, so that's the McMinnville, the well-known one. But we had the inside track on probably a relatively unknown museum by comparison. So little old WAM there, up the gorge, up the Columbia River Gorge. And they got a Model T outside, you know, just sort of parked there. And you're like, wow, that's a pretty serious Model T. Looks like you could drive it. Well, it turns out that's sort of one of the signatures of this place. They drive an amazing amount of the stuff in here. You just almost can't believe what gets driven and flown. And I'm not going to be able to remember the names of the types of planes. But one of the really cool things is that it's really well organized. When you walk in, if you turn left, you go to the oldest planes. These planes are 100 years old. Now, the Wright brothers would only be 110 years old, roughly. And there was a model of a plane that looks an awful lot like a Wright brothers plane, but with a better motor, a bigger motor, a horrifically large motor that's probably double the horsepower from 5 to 10. You know, your lawnmower has 5. The Wright brothers' first engine had 5 horsepower. It was a lawnmower engine. Only it was probably 20 times larger than a lawnmower engine. You know. Anyway, so you go look at these 100-year-old planes, and they're, you know, everything is approachable. Like, they all have signs, they all have history. Like, this plane appeared in movies, it appeared in this movie and that movie. This plane has flown. Like, they'll tell you the actual trips that this plane has made in its lifetime. They'll have, like, a map with all the trips on it. They'll talk about who donated it, who owns it, who flies it. And then you look under the planes, and if they have a pan, like a large, like a pan, like in a cafeteria tray, if they have a large cafeteria tray underneath, they are flown. They are regularly flown. And you suddenly realize this museum was very alive. And really, in a way, in a sense, you could say this museum is really, it's a clever way to store your airplane. You can buy a really cool plane, and you can donate it to these guys. I don't even know if they're officially donated or if they're owned and available, whatever that status is. But someone ends up storing your plane for you, right? And then you fly it periodically. It sounds kind of sweet. So that's the, you know, just the planes kind of aspect of it. But they also have cars, amazing number of cars, old cars, Studebakers and all that stuff. Model Ts, of course, and, you know, old Cadillacs from 100 years ago. Packards and 10 types of cars I can't remember the names of. But, again, to have the guides or the people that work there. And, like, I worked on the railway in my past, many moons ago, 30 years ago. I worked on the railway. Good experience, good place to be from. It's kind of a rough job. It's a dirty job. You're always dirty. Very male-dominated, like on the track or when you're working on the sections, the maintenance side of it is very male-dominated. And when you get into driving a train or traffic control, you know, you'll get more women into the business. But so you're surrounded by guys all day, every day kind of thing. You're on a dirty track. The passenger train goes by and someone goes to the bathroom. And when they do, it just goes right out the bottom of the passenger train. Maybe they've changed that today, but it used to be that way. You'd be walking on the tracks and you find the almost unrecognizable evidence of someone having relieved themselves in a train, passing train. You know, so the railway was relatively well paid. People retired there, which is sort of hard for me to imagine. I couldn't wait to get out. But, you know, it was relatively well paid. I was there 2.5 years. I saved money so I could go back to university, finish my engineering degree. And I saved, it turned out over a 2.5 year period, I saved 50% of the money I was paid. Gross. 50% of my gross I saved. Net after 3 years, and that was pretty darn good. You know, most people can't save 5% from 1 week to the next kind of thing, or maybe not most people, it's not fair, but it's hard for us to save 10%, let's put it that way, and I was saving 50. So I was very sure I didn't drink, I didn't, you know, didn't do, just didn't spend my money. Half the time I was in a camp somewhere, so it was almost impossible to spend money, unless you gambled. Railway people are such characters. So it was great to have that background of railway people, because it is its own world. It's a little bit like ships, like ocean ships. That's a very interesting world. I have another friend who, he was a ship's captain. He went all the way up from working on a tugboat to being a tugboat skipper to being a captain to being a ship's pilot. For example, a cruise ship, when a cruise ship is traveling, it's always in somebody's waters, you know, basically. And you need a, I don't know about that, I'll correct that. As you get into where harbors are, where busy areas are, you need a pilot at that point, maybe for it to actually dock in that harbor. And so they'll run on a smaller boat. They'll run a pilot out to the big cruise ship. He'll climb aboard, and he'll be the one driving when it drives into a port. This happens all the time. If you're on a cruise ship, it probably happens 20, 30 times throughout your cruise. Unless maybe the cruise ships have a trick because they want to speed things up, right? They don't want you waiting at anchor all the time for a pilot to come out. But, you know, maybe they have people that know the water, or they have special docks so that when they dock there, they don't need pilotage, or they just don't need as much. I'd be curious about that. So that one fellow was a pilot. Very interesting. One time I rode with him, as you can see, I'm going to extreme ramble today. Let's call this my double good news at the start, because I think I'm lacking one good one to finish up with. So I'm going to give you two back-to-back at the start. So the first one is this really cool museum. And the second good thing back-to-back is just random good stuff about working on the railway and stuff and ship's pilots. So I went with this guy one time. He was piloting in Vancouver Harbor, Vancouver, Canada Harbor. And so there was a boat that had to move from one part of the harbor to another. To do that, he's a ship's pilot. So he gets called up. He's like, hey, you want to come with me? I'm like, you bet. Away we go. We get there. We get dropped off. There's the ship. Just, you know, it's one thing to see a ship moving in the water. And you go, yeah, that's a ship moving in the water. But when you're up next to it, you're like, wow, this thing goes on forever. Look how tall it is. And, you know, it's got this gangplank on the side of it. I'd love to know the history of gangplank. Anyway, it's designed that it can go up and down and it can swing out, right? So that if the tides change or whatever relative to the dock, and it can compensate. And also, let's say the guy doesn't moor where you want it, or you know, to board it in a civilized fashion. This thing is designed to, probably in some cases anyway, to swing or in some way. But often they're just on the side of the ship. Well, this one was on the side of the ship. So I'm just going along with this guy, and he's, you know, very much sort of, I was going to say businesslike. That's not really fair to him. He is just he's a doer. So when he was called up, he was doing. So I was scampering along after him to do right along with him. And so there you are. You're 20 feet up above the water, right? You don't want to fall off the dock, right? And there's this ship stuck next to the dock. And it isn't an exact science. It isn't like there's no room in between. There's plenty of room in between. You can see water in between, you know. It's like docks and everything. And the closer you get to it, the more you realize it isn't all just the same. So the point is, you have to step from the dock to the ship. Well, this friend of mine, without missing a beat, just practically leapt off the dock right onto the ship. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm doing it too. And without hesitating, I stepped off the dock, grabbed onto the, you know, the railing. It's like a cable. And start climbing up this railing thing, scampering up the side of the ship to catch up to him, you know. Well, the first funny thing was to realize that when he stepped onto that gangplank thing, he didn't grab onto it. I did, and I got lots of grease in my hands. You know, you're on a ship, rust is a real factor. And also, you don't want metal wearing out, and then you have, you know, metal fraying, and then you have, you know, something that's really dangerous. And so you put grease on stuff, especially on metal. So these sort of cables on this gangplanky thing were all greased up. And I thought, okay, that's my first learning experience right there, and I enjoyed that. So we get up to the bridge, and the other memorable thing on this ship was we take off from the dock, and it's about as uneventful as something can get. You are barely aware on the ship of anything happening, period. And so, like, you pull away, and I don't even remember what the signals were or if it was obvious when we had left the dock. And we start headed to the other part of the harbor. The harbor's a good-sized harbor. It's, you know, it's miles long, and it's one of the well-known harbors in the world. And we got to go through one of the busier parts of the harbor. You might say from the front of it to the back of it. We're going to the back of it. And we're going all the way to the back of it. So we're going, I don't know, I'm going to say 5 miles along the inlet, Burrard Inlet. And so the first thing we do is we start heading for what's called Second Arrows Bridge, one of the two big bridges that crosses the harbor. And we're pointed at this bridge, and we're just going along, going, going. And it doesn't seem like, you know, if I was driving, you have this thought like, man, I would like tweak it a little bit. Like, it seems like we're not, you know, sort of lined up perfectly. And how can we just keep going in a straight line? Like, we have a steering wheel, right? And, you know, you're just sort of cut, like we just sort of cut across. Think of it like you're on a road and you're on the wrong side of the road. Like, you've pulled off to your left. And now you want to get back onto the road and onto the right. But let's imagine you take 2 miles to get onto the right-hand side of the road. That's what it felt like. In part because we did start on the left-hand side. We were going to our left, and we were on the left-hand side going left. And so it was like that. And I just remember this fellow saying something like, when things are going okay, you know, don't change anything. Something like that. And I, you know, it's been so many years. It's probably been 15 or 20 years, and I've forgotten exactly what he said. But it was quite insightful. Don't mess with the wheel. Don't oversteer that ship. It's all fine. You're gradually crossing that inlet. The inlet is quite wide. It might be at least a half a mile wide. And you're aiming at the bridge, and everything was fine. And only when he, you know, had to make another correction, did he make another correction. And so that was sort of the second insight of that ship, of that travel on that ship. And, you know, talking about how heavy it was and just riding on it and whatnot was a great experience. So that was, that was my one and only experience on a non-passenger ship of the ocean. And it was great. It was really, really awesome. So, this friend of mine who was giving this tour of WAM, the Western Antique Aeroplane and Automobile Museum, he worked on the railway, as I did. So, some of the same, you know, they talk about the railways being romantic, and it is. There's a romance behind it, just like there's a romance of the sea, a romance of flying. There's a romance of transportation, but not romance like, you know, chick flick, male, female falling in love. The romance is like you love it. Some part of you loves some part of it. Flying, it's kind of easy to see, right? We've been caught up with flying ever since we invented it. It's easy to see. Ships maybe is the next easiest to see, and the hardest to see is the railway, because most of us don't ride on the railway either very much, or when we do, we're purely as passengers. We get on, we get off, and that's it. You know, maybe we stay in coach, maybe we, you know, sleep overnight in a bunk on a train or something, or if we've traveled to another country, we might ride more on trains, but we don't have the same experience, and we sure haven't worked on them, worked on the track. And the thing with the railway is, when you're working the track, you're often in the middle of nowhere. You're the only person for 10 miles in any direction sometimes. And that's a unique experience and quite enjoyable. Not if you're just by yourself. I was usually a helper or a maintainer myself. And so I usually either helped somebody or somebody helped me. And that's the way it should be, because if something goes bad and you're by yourself, now what? And of course, the thing about the railway is that the railway, they say, of all the transportation services, it has the highest fixed costs. And why is that? What is that? Like, you would think, maybe what about ships on the ocean? Well, ships on the ocean, you know, you have the cost of the ship, and you got to paint it, and you got to, you know, keep the engines working. But you don't have to maintain the ocean. You don't have to pave anything. So you got docks, but docks is maybe like a large parking lot, you might say, versus having to do all the roads. So you can see why ships are the cheapest. They are the cheapest way to ship something from, to send something from A to B is to ship it on a ship. The second cheapest is on a train. The third more expensive of the three options is a truck. In part, a truck is expensive because it shares a road, and the road has to be paved and all that. And in part, it's because it's a smaller amount of stuff with one pilot, with one truck driver. And so you get the economy of scale, obviously, on a ship where you could be carrying up to 500,000 tons. It's really boggling. It's like saying 500,000 carloads, like cars. You could carry, you know, in theory, they, you know, typically are carrying oil, those really big ones, but they're truly enormous. So 500,000 tons. But then on the railway, I think it's 1,200 tons. Let's work it out. That's not right. Hang on. Let me work it out. All right, so on the railway, the cars typically are in the 100-ton category, 200,000 pounds or 100 tons, one car. Trains typically 100 cars long, so rough rule of thumb, 10,000 tons. And that's for a fully loaded, like a wheat train, a coal train, potash train, the trains I know about, sulfur train, what they call unit trains, trains that operate as a unit. They don't get connected or disconnected ever. They're designed to continuously dump when they get to where they're going. And they can continuously load, so they never get disconnected, which is kind of awesome. A true train. You know, it never stops being a train. It's always connected. I worked in British Columbia in the Rocky Mountains. Big things there were wheat, sulfur, potash, and coal. Coal trains were the biggest amazing beasts, and they had dedicated engines in the middle that were always coupled in the middle of the train. And then in the one camp I worked at in the Rogers Pass, which was at that time the last remaining steepest spot on the Canadian Pacific Railway, which is 20,000 miles of track. It's a pretty big one. In this camp, they hooked on six more engines, and so they had a total of a dozen engines. Each engine is something like 3,000 to 5,000 horsepower. So you're looking at 36,000 horsepower to push this train up this hill. So it's kind of a spectacular, kind of amazing. Three sets of engines. It would be like four, and then three, and then the from the camp, they get another five, I think. Four, three, and five, is that right? Yeah, that's 12, yeah. Marvelous, marvelous, fantastic thing. So that's sort of the, if you're working on the railway, that's like the thing you remember because it's the biggest. But there's so many aspects of the railway, and, you know, you have to have your own signal wires. You have to have your own cases and your own equipment. I've wired the cases and the crossings, like a railway crossing, when you have the gates and all that stuff. I've wired and hooked up every single aspect of that from one end to the other, from designing from an empty case, taking the plans for that particular crossing and hooking the whole thing up, stripping the wires. And I don't know if they were solder. I'm trying to remember. I think it was all connectors. Yeah, I think you would crimp connectors onto the wire, and it was all crimped connectors. So you never lose that. You never lose that love of the railway when you've had that experience. I only worked there like 3 years. Well, my friend who was giving the Wham Museum tour, he worked on the railway, I don't know, decades. I don't know how many decades. I think 30 years or something. So he is really steeped in the railway. Well, you know what happens is you end up being technical. Like on the railway, you have something called a speeder, the little car that, in the earliest days, those were push cars. You had a lever. You pedaled yourself with this lever that you operated with your hands. That's how you propelled yourself. And then they had these little one-cylinder gasoline engines, two-stroke gasoline engines. Super simple. Phenomenal. Great experience to work with a super simple engine. Again, that you can take apart completely and you understand every part of it. And some of the fun things with those engines, they were designed to go both directions. And there was like a belt. It was like a belt drive. And so if you could get the engine to simply fire in reverse, then you still engage the belt, and in and out it was going the other direction. And so it was fun that you would shut it off, and as it was winding down, it was like poof, 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 poof. And right around there, you throw the spark lever the other direction, and you're trying to get it to fire the other way. It was a bit of an art. Sometimes you'd miss, and then it stopped, and then you had to crank it the other way. And you could crank it. Now I'm thinking, could you crank it either direction that you wanted? You must have been able to do that. Yeah. So speeders were kind of fun. So again, everyone had the experience of speeders on the railway at that time. He sure did, and I did, you know. So we had this sort of a commonality, a common background, sort of a technical working with equipment, working with machines, having to accomplish mission impossible type stuff, difficult stuff in tough conditions and long hours and interesting stuff that most people don't run across. So we had that as a sort of a background. And, you know, he's been this plane buff for a very long time. And my father was a huge plane buff and sort of rubbed off on me to some extent. I told my father that, you know, he was into planes, I was into space. Because it was kind of like the next logical step. So as we'd walk around, my friend Don would, you'd either ask him questions or he'd volunteer stuff. Like, yeah, that engine there, such and such, so and so. And you'd be like, oh, really? And then you'd ask more questions and bang, he had answers. And the amazing thing was how it brought it all to life. That was the first time that I sort of looked at museums differently in a long time. And, you know, admittedly, I can see that I sort of have a gray definition of what is a museum. A museum is something I didn't like. That's how I defined it before. And if it was something I enjoyed, then it was just something interesting. And, oh, yeah, I saw a bunch of whatever, and I didn't think of it as being a museum. Well, this time I just really realized, and sometimes they'd be available, and they'd help us, and they'd tour guide for us. And then they'd maybe get busy, and I'd be by myself for a minute or two. And it was like someone turned the lights out on the exhibits. The light went out. As soon as they weren't talking about it, it was just old junk again lying around. And that was really interesting. Really, it made me appreciate them even more. So we were just, you know, so appreciative afterwards. And there's just a lot to think about there because, oh, the other funny thing at this museum, Wham, I was like a kid there because everyone was 10 years older than me or more. You know, all the volunteers are all like, you know, retired and they're either old or really old. And it was funny. It was fun to... And sort of a bit rare these days to be the young one. That was, you know, good for a grin. And these guys were working on steam tractors. They were taking people on drives on, you know, Model A, Model T cars. They were taking off with them. I wish I could remember the type of plane. There was a famous plane that, if you've ever seen the old days of barnstorming, where people would do crazy stunts with planes, and in movies, this was the plane they were taking off with anyway. And there's a whole bunch of them there. And this museum has a ton of aircraft, a ton of everything, and it's all open hangar doors, out they go. Like, stuff is happening all the time. There's crazy contraptions there, and there's a great kids area. Wow. Everything in the kids area looks real. There's what looks like a real helicopter, a real control tower, a real submarine, and, you know, five other things I can't think of at the moment. And all of them are sort of mock-ups, you know, where someone has put stuff together to make it look like you know, maybe they've taken old parts, because this place has a lot of old parts, you know, and a lot of hangars, and some of them are just sort of storage hangars with old parts, and, you know, basically planes that they've taken apart, I imagine, and they've used an engine from it here, and they've used such and such there, and then they got parts left over, right? And so it's almost like art. You know how some guys will take, you know, scrapyard, they'll take scrap metal and they'll make art out of it. It's almost like that. But it looked that much more realistic. And in some cases, they had the radios from the actual... Oh, and this museum is right next to an airport. In this airport, which is literally like one city block away, they have the radios from the airport into that kid's room. And so there was like a helicopter, sort of a dummy helicopter, but inside it had like pedals and like a whole bunch of stuff that made it look very realistic. And they had the radios from the control tower. And so you could hear actual planes taking off and everything they would say while you're in that helicopter. Just that kids area alone was fantastic. Fantastic, man. Best kids area maybe I've ever seen. Oh, and then their relative, these friends of mine, their relative, their grandson, was one of the people volunteering in the kids area, which was, you know, yet another sort of icing on the cake thing. But they had like steam cars that, you know, Jay Leno has a Stanley Steamer. Stanley Steamer was sort of famous, one of the first, you know, practical cars 110 years ago. Stanley Steamer, you know, runs on steam. The interesting thing, Stanley Steamer, you have to build up your steam. And it doesn't condense it. It doesn't reuse it. It just goes out the stack and you're gone. And so it takes more energy to heat up the steam. It takes more time. And then it doesn't go as far because it's exhausting the steam and the water in the steam. And you're losing both the energy, which is in steam, and you're losing the water itself. And so your range on a Stanley Steamer is very limited. Anyway, they had one of those. Looked great. They had other steam cars where they used condensers and whatnot, and they're more efficient. And they had a bunch of those. I mean, anything your heart could desire. Of course, they had, you know, weapons. Just as an example, they had like just a few weapons cabinets, not a lot. But the cool thing was, every single weapon was like from a different country. Like, clearly they had a ton to draw from, and they were just using, you know, one from Czechoslovakia, one from Hungary, one from, you know, and it just went on and on like that. They had a bunch of Moses Nagants or whatever, the Russian, famous Russian sniper rifle from Enemy at the Gates. The Russian stock and the German, or vice versa. Two snipers going at it. The famous Moses Nagant, the Russian rebel. They had two or three of those just in the display case. They had other assault, you know, not assault rifles, sniper rifles. But again, it's in a case that you just lean right over, and it's like you're in the store and you're going to buy a gun. Like, what I'm saying is totally approachable. Everything totally approachable. No distance with anything. And fun to walk around and look underneath, and yeah, there's the Pan. They're driving that vehicle. They had, you know, famous people that donated vehicles. One famous guy, Pat Boone, famous singer from probably 50 years ago. He had a Gullwing Mercedes. And I guess this is a very valuable car. Anyway, he just donated it to the museum. A lot of people have done this. So this museum is just not your average museum. It's very approachable. It has a ton of stuff in there. It's well laid out. I've been in museums where it doesn't feel well laid out. This is very well laid out in the sense of chronology, especially with the planes. Because in planes, you would go 10 years in planes and you would be amazed at the improvements. And you'd go another 10 years and the horsepower had doubled and they had, you know, enclosed cockpits or mufflers on the engine. Maybe not mufflers. The pipes were longer. In the early days, the engines had, the pipe would be less than a foot long. In your car, the muffler goes underneath the length of your car. It's 15 feet long, and it's got a large muffler to reduce noise. It's got a catalytic converter, which also reduces noise, and it's got a resonator, which is tuned to the whole rest of the exhaust system, and it's designed specifically to cut down remaining noise. So you have, there's four things right there to cut down noise. In planes, in the early days, they had zero. They had a 1 foot pipe coming out of a cylinder. Loud wouldn't begin to describe it. Well, 10 years later, they started to collect those exhausts, and they started running underneath the plane. So that was one of the innovations 10 years later, and then the enclosed cockpits, and then they just started to look sleeker. The propellers started to look better. The early propellers looked like a caveman club, some of them. They looked amazingly primitive, hard to believe if it was ever on an airplane. One of them I have in mind. I mean, this propeller, at its thickest parts, was like 6 inches thick. Not, you know, how fat it is or how wide it is when you look at it, but how thick the wood was in the dimension that wasn't helping. Let's put it that way. You know, in theory, a propeller could be as thin as a piece of paper and it would work, in theory, just about. And so, say it could be 1 inch thick. And so anything more than an inch is sort of wasted and you need it only just to keep it strong, right? Well, in those early days, they didn't know how to make a strong propeller. So literally, one of the propellers was like 6 inch thick wood. Wow. and some of them were beautiful stainless, looked like stainless steel or chromed steel propellers. Again, you're totally up close to this stuff. Things like Piper, the famous Piper Cub. Well, I guess Piper and some other guy, I've forgotten his name, they built planes together. Tucker, I think. Piper and Tucker. They built planes together for a while. And so there was literally like a Piper, like one of the first ones ever, and then right next to it was a Tucker, I think it is. And they were basically the same plane. They were each making the same plane. And things like that that you didn't know. They had puzzles of planes, and I like puzzles, of course, and I bought one, and I'm halfway through it. It was rich. And to meet the people, the guys working on this old steam tractor. Steam tractors ran for about 40 years. It's kind of amazing. Just before internal combustion tractors started to become popular, it was steam tractors. Leviathan. That's the word I'm looking for. They are Leviathans. Estimated, 50,000-pound tractor. Whereas a modern tractor might be, 5,000 pounds. Enormous, like as tall as your house almost. Certainly 8 feet tall, maybe 10 to 12 feet tall. It's got to have a boiler where this one was burning wood, huge big boiler. Then they had pipes going through that, and then the pipes go through another area where they heat up a water tank to make steam. The wheels were special, kind of pure metal wheels with spokes, metal spokes, and very thin, just sort of rubber around the perimeter of the wheel. It was before the tire as we think of it. And these guys are working on it. Old guys going at it. And one guy, he worked with the original guys who worked on these tractors and these steam things. He learned from them. And now Harry was 7 years old, probably, just going at it on this tractor. It's the kind of thing that makes you want to donate your time. It makes you want to hang out with these guys and hear their stories and bring it to life. That place really brought the last 100 years of transportation. It brought it to life. Fantastic. The gift shop, extensive gift shop, good prices. I remember in McMinnville, it was all like, look but don't touch even, These prices were like half the price of the McMinnville one. So we bought a bunch of stuff. It's just sort of typical of the place, A really great experience. And so that was going to be my 1 of 5, but I turned it into 2, and I'm already almost at the end of this podcast. There was one bad thing I did want to talk about, and it's not, a vital concern. You'll be pleased to hear I'm not talking about wireless this week. What I'm talking about is the new Google Maps. Google Maps, when MapQuest, when mapping first started on the computer, it was amazing, right? And then Google Maps came along. And then amazing just sort of went from, wow, we're orbiting the Earth, to, wow, we just landed on the moon. Like, Google Maps, when it first came out, was so revolutionary to me. It blew away the category, like the rest of them might as well quit. And it's continued to progress, right? Because then they did Street View, and then they integrated Street View into Google Maps, and, stops of interest, and then how do you want to travel, by walking, by bike, by car. Google Maps just continues to grow and grow and grow, and it's just so awesome. Until just recently, someone was using their machine and was like, hey, what's happened to Google Maps? I can't use it. And I guess there's a new version of Google Maps. I even know the name of the guy who has been in charge of designing this thing, Jonah Jones. I got a quote from him here. The main idea behind the redesign of Google Maps was to make the experience as immersive as possible and to remove clutter by only giving users the information they need. Well, that's always a tip-off that they're about to shaft you when they only give you what you need. There's a trend nowadays where they gut user interfaces. Windows 8 is a perfect example of this. They have gutted the interface, and they have come up with this hideous product. It is so it's spectacularly unusable under the guise of being easy to use. This is a trend across so many systems and services, like Ubuntu, the Linux. They came up with a version of GNOME, and everyone just was up in arms about it. This attempt at, I don't think they're being sincere when they say they're trying to simplify. I don't think they're being sincere. I can see some of the real gains they're trying for. Number one, if you give people too many choices of what to do in an interface, they're going to choose the wrong thing. Yeah, I deleted the file, and then I did 6 hours of work. Can you help me get it back? No, you deleted it 6 hours ago. Sorry. So I think these dumbed-down interfaces are designed so that people do less with their machine. Well, if they do less, then they phone you less, and then you have less support cost. I think that's part of it. But I think also part of it is kind of a hideous or insidious thing that there's a desire to dumb us all down. I mean, they do that in everything, right? You know, you give someone meat to eat, and you dumb them down. They're not as smart as a vegetarian. It's as simple as that. They're not as energetic. They can't run as fast. You've dumbed them down. You give them microwaves, and you've dumbed them down. They just can't get through a day barely, let alone change the world. And so I think with the interface, it's the same thing. What they're really saying is, you know, we used the computer, we encouraged the computer for decades because we knew we would benefit from the computer. Well, now we've got our benefits, and now we want to turn the interface down a notch. It's like the movie Idiocracy. If you want to check out a really good movie, when Idiocracy first came out, it was created by Fox, or financed by Fox. And Fox, you know, is always, you know, sort of leading edge. This movie was so leading edge that they were afraid, and they didn't release it when it first came out. And of course, today, they now, you know, 20 years later, they now show it regularly on Comedy Central. Watch Idiocracy. That's what's happening to us right now with interfaces on computing systems. They are being dumbed down. This new Google Maps is like that. Fortunately, we found out there's a way to set it so that it doesn't. It goes back to the old interface. You can change that default. And, you know, in fairness to the new Google Maps, there is the immersive experience they talk about. There are some new features that are like, wow, I can't believe it. It actually feels like you're looking out the window of your car rather than a street view, which feels like you are right outside of a store. When you look outside of your car, say, and you have a view of, the city, you know, you could be looking 3 miles away. In other words, you can see 3 miles of city. And some of the views look like that. So salute to them on some of the visuals, but 0 out of 10 for what they took away and how annoying they made it. They made it as dumb as Windows 8. So that's my downer. And the other thing, okay, maybe I'll close it enough because it's about the right amount of time to close here. The spruce tree that I transplanted is doing phenomenal. Every day I look at this tree. If it was alive, if it was like a pet, I would be talking to it and patting it. I'm studying it in detail. You can see it's growing. It, you know, it's already putting out new growth. It's happy. It's, you know, it's upright, erect. You know, it's not like drooping. And it's not, no brown branches. And boy, it feels great to have transplanted that and given it a life, right? It's just like rescuing a pet, really, in its own way. You've now moved this to like prime real estate. And the tree goes, hey, I dig it. I got more sunlight and I got room to spread my branches and don't have weeds growing up over top of me. And it's just so happy and it just looks so great. There's nothing quite like looking at a freshly growing bush or tree or whatever and just to see it in all of its vibrant. You know, nature doesn't fool around. Nature takes advantage of growth opportunities. So there's a lesson in it for us to take advantage of growth opportunities, to really try and grow yourself. That's one of the things I do want to talk about is, I'm going to try and squeeze a couple more things in here. One is, you know, I want to kind of plug some of my videos just because, and I was thinking about this today, that one I want to plug today is called Thinking Your Own Thoughts. You really should check it out. You know, this world, as I say, this world does not want you to think your own thoughts. Absolutely not. Of course, one of the ways they accomplish this is by saying, yeah, you got freedom, you can do whatever you want, which is the opposite of thinking your own thoughts. Opposite. Seems like the same. In theory, the same. If you are in control of yourself, they can be the same. A person who's in control, whether they're in prison or not, they sort of carry on the same way each day, right? Because they just sort of work with what they got, and that's that. Most of us don't do that. So I recommend thinking your own thoughts. And I would like to see that become more popular and more appreciated and therefore more benefited by others. I think there's something there. You know, we're just not taught to think for ourselves. And there's just so much in that. And related to that is, how many people do you know change or like to change? How many things do you change in a year? Think about that. Just think about it. And what do you change? You know, clothes doesn't count. Upgrading your game, your software from, you know, level 2 to level 3, adding another 10 levels to World of Warcraft, you know, that doesn't count. That's not a change. No matter how different it is, it's not a change. What do you change? How hard is it to change? You know, the more important something is, usually the harder it is to change. Anyway, the other thing I did today is I went and got water, mountain water, and I'm going to save that for next week. So, this is Floyd Maxwell, justthinkit.com. You're listening to Floydcast number 4.
Good luck with your life. Take care.